Welcome to the latest episode of Out of Left Field Podcast. We are podcasting from the Gulag Archipelago of Soviet Kanakistan, otherwise known as beautiful Vancouver Island. Thank you for tuning in. I am your co-host and producer, Ben, in the house. We also have Mac.
Yeah, me as well.
And Anthony.
Hello.
We have no guest today. It's just the three of us, and we're going to pontificate on some of the recent goings-on in the world, including the U.S. election, or rather the Democratic primaries, the ongoing Wet'suwet'en anti-pipeline protests, and whatever else comes to mind.
Oh, you're sounding a little bit hoarse there, Ben. You just got back from a trip, right? Are you holding some information, withholding that
I
you
feel fine, thank you very much.
All right. So that is good.
And I just would like to say, the guest we tried to get on, I hope he's feeling better very soon.
Yeah, the
mysterious illness he's under is...
For reasons.
So, I am back from 3 weeks in the Great Satan. It's good to be home. The last two episodes that were released were kind of pre-recorded, so apologies for not having our thumb on the pulse of the latest goings-ons, but we're going to make that up for you right now. We got a couple of quick announcements before we get started. Number one, I recently set up a chat room, Slack room for our patrons. So if you are a donator to the show monthly, you should have received an email with an invite to our Slack channel. We're on there chatting politics with each other, so the more the merrier. Please do stop on by. If you want to support the show, we are on patreon.com/outofleftfieldpodcast. Follow us on Twitter @RealOolf. Like our Facebook page. Like and subscribe, and give us a good review on iTunes if you got a couple minutes.
Yeah, hit that bell.
So I'm back from 3 weeks in the Great Satan. The weather was great, and
hot.
I'm happy to be home.
Uh-huh.
So
the frosty north, uh-huh. Yes.
It's supposed to snow this weekend, actually.
You're fucking kidding me.
No.
Come on.
It was 26 degrees when I was there. This is Phoenix. It doesn't snow often there, but anyway, there's little things that are different about the United States that you can't, you know, sometimes makes you appreciate some of the little things.
Such as
in Canada.
What? They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese down there?
Or they use the word beanie instead of toque and many other, you know,
wow,
anecdotal differences. But no, so, for one, people frown upon drinking the tap water. So that was a little bit of a small thing that I kind of took for granted here at home.
It's because 20% of the cities don't have drinkable tap water. That's a made-up statistic.
And when I went to one of the restaurants, they had a no firearms sign at the very front, so like a no smoking sign, but there was a handgun. That was a little off-putting.
What do you mean? That's the kind of thing you want to see. What do you want? You want like a yes firearm sign in front of the restaurant?
Well, it just never occurred to me that, I mean, maybe in restaurants that I went to that didn't have, like, maybe there were people packing. I don't know, because it's legal to carry a concealed fucking weapon.
Were there bullet holes in the ceilings? Did you notice anything like
that? I didn't notice, but anyway, enough of that. I'm happy to be back. We have some good interviews lined up for you in the near future, and we may have an exciting announcement to make in the near future as well, which may or may not result in a lot more content on this show. That's all I'm going to say for now. That being said, what did you guys want to start talking about?
Oh, boy, so much stuff has been going on in the news. I mean, this last month or so, there's been a horrible disease that's been spreading across North America, state by state, region by region, city by city. It's incapacitating and paralyzing people's lives. No one knows what to do. And I just want to know what we're going to do about Joe Biden.
I wasn't sure if you were going to say Biden or the Democratic primaries in
general. I
actually
have like three things on this list I could have just thrown in there on that. Yeah. You know?
I mean, I have so many thoughts on this. I feel like Biden's campaign insisting that he continue is kind of elder abuse at this point. Like, I mean, it's... I think Biden is a ghoul, and I think he's consistently stood on the wrong side of history for his entire career, and I'd like nothing about him. But it's really honestly just sad, like, seeing his cognitive decline in real time on national television, and I just feel fucking bad for the guy. He should honestly drop out. I think it's that he is the candidate that the Democratic establishment chose speaks volumes on where the Democratic Party is at.
He wasn't the first choice. He wasn't the second choice. He wasn't even really, like, the 10th choice. He was just sort of there and wouldn't go away before someone else became the choice.
It's starting to feel like the Democratic Party establishment are just actual necromancers, infusing the dead with their kind of cultish magic.
Well, you suck the life out of the healthier candidates.
What does Vampire Capital have to say about that?
To keep the Biden machine alive.
I honestly think that, like, not just the Democratic, but the general political leadership in the United States, you know, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, the Bush family. I mean, it looks like the fucking Politburo from the declining Soviet Union in, like, the, like, late 80s, where they're all, like, 70, 80 odd years, like, octogenarians, basically, or septuagenarians, and it's like, they're getting pretty old.
Yeah, but who can you trust other than that the last generation who, like, was raised in steeped in the successes of neoliberalism, when, like, cutting costs actually did make huge profits happen. And now it's like, you can't really do that. That, like, these days, the people you get are more like the Pete Buttigieg's, who are like, you know, you implement austerity so that you can get a job as, like, a social media influencer to, like, tell other people why actually it's a good thing, even though the economy is still stagnating. That's the, like, the world we live in of austerity. Whereas back in their day, if you can imagine, you cut those labor costs, you crushed this or that union, and the economy actually bounces back and things from a stocks and, you know, investment standpoint get really good. But now it's like, yeah, that was like 40 years ago. It's you're going to have a hard time finding anyone who really believes in that shit who isn't 80-ish years old.
Well, not only that, but, I mean, all of, like, when you ask, you know, your typical lib in the United States why they support the Democratic Party or liberalism or whatever, it's always things like, oh, you know, the Clean Water Act and other reforms and bills
Rights
that
Acts,
were passed, like, 40 years ago. Like, what have you done lately other than, like, drone strike civilians and privatize things and get buddy-buddy with Goldman Sachs?
Well, even torpedo any shot of your own relevancy continually.
Yeah.
Well, even NAFTA was like 30 years ago. Like, that was the last major shift, and that's still, like, that's A, not popular, B, has been, you know, there's been attempts to try and change it, but that's really gone nowhere. And yeah, so I don't think there's any surprise it's going to be Biden, and maybe Hillary Clinton will run again in another 4 years. Why not? Because, you know, who else are you going to get?
They're going to sacrifice Pete Buttigieg to her specifically. He's going to write another one of those high school essays praising her for her principles and moral authority. I had to shed a tear for Buttigieg on that one. I always thought that he was a little bit daft, but given that he wrote that Bernie essay and then the party brass twisted his arm and he tumbled out at the same time as every other delegate lined up behind Biden and Warren at the time, before Super Tuesday, that one made me a little bit sad. The loss of principles and just destruction of any kind of political inspiration he might have once had was palpable in that one. You know, I have to actually comment then on one of the other candidates who dropped out more recently, Elizabeth Warren, because I believe I'm on record last time we were talking about this in the episode you mentioned, Ben, of really going to bat for her and kind of having that skittish skepticism about Bernie's viability of his candidacy mm-hmm, through mm-hmm. Through the primaries. And I definitely have to recant some of that now, just with the sheer force that Bernie's campaign has been, and I'm very happy to do so. But Liz Warren's at a kind of pivotal moment right now, where I think she definitely suffered from a kind of strong centrist drift. It was already always there, but I think by the time of her dropping out, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about which candidate she might endorse and how that might be pivotal, given the pretty equal ratios of delegate counts after Super Tuesday. she's at this kind of decisive moment, and she's shown a momentum towards, I think, opting for Biden or for nothing,
I don't think she's gonna,
is effectively Biden.
Of all the candidates, this is true of every political candidate in Canada or anywhere else, people invest in them their own opinions to some extent, but they start to sort of imagine versions of these candidates that frankly don't exist, like Chairman Sanders is like this, you know, Stalin-like figure who's all going to lead us to revolution. And it's like, that's not true. That's not a real person. That's a fictional character you've made up. And people, broadly speaking, I think, are aware of that, but it does sort of seep into how they interpret decisions, so that when Bernie Sanders makes a fairly milquetoast criticism indirectly of Biden following Super Tuesday in a speech where he's like, I was the candidate who did good stuff, and the other guy, who won't be named, was the candidate who did bad stuff. It's not just sort of a vague attempt at like differentiating the two remaining candidates. It's a direct attack on the very foundations of, you know, liberalism, and it is the, like, it's a broadside against Biden's right-wing policies. And with Warren, there's a similar sort of thing that happened where it was like, and I think Warren was probably the worst for this, in that you could sort of invest in her whatever politics you wanted her to have. Mm. And it really seemed it all seemed reasonable. Is she the former Republican who can't be trusted ever again? Is she a reasonable technocratic centrist whose policies are going to materially improve people's lives but are possible, quote unquote, compared to Bernie Sanders? Is she just a leftist? Is she basically just Bernie Sanders but I don't know, appealing to a more academically minded crowd? It turns out none of that really is true. And I think that if we're going to try to understand these candidates, we really have to just sort of take them at their word at times as to what they actually have said about themselves. And like, Sanders is not affecting a revolution. He's not trying to destroy the Democratic Party. Warren is.
Although he should be.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Fine, but given. Like, again, he's not actually trying to do that. He's trying to do other things. Biden is not trying to, do a right-wing coup. He is just, as he said, he's just, you know, good times and, you know, surfing USA.
He's trying to mix up his words at this point.
Well,
yeah. I mean, it's just almost daily gaffes with
him. And Warren is, I think she just has a series of good ideas. And to be perfectly honest, I think she's a fairly, I think she takes politics personally. Like, I think a lot of this is about, as she has said, relationships between people. And so it's not really a matter of, like, broad political philosophies for Warren as much as it's, you know, do I agree with this meeting with this person? Do I now agree with them, and will I support them? And so on that basis, like, who is Warren going to support will probably be entirely based on her personal opinion of Biden and Sanders, and not on some kind of grand political vision.
I think that's a really savvy analysis in a couple of ways, because You know, on the one hand, this kind of interpersonal politics or the blending of the political and the personal speaks a little bit to the discourse around her campaign and the online invectives of the Bernie bros, you know, how there's this kind of nebulous space between political discourse and personal insults and bullying and antagonism. I'm not sure how much it's constructed by the discourse and how much it's the personalities involved, you know, to which it gravitates. But, you know, I don't want to touch that one with a 10-foot long pole. But then the other thing, right, is that kind of weird political fragmented unity that it attracts. What I always heard about Warren is she puts out so many practical, again, concrete ideas, proposals. But to see how those things are all kind of hanging together and what the overall trajectory is really hard. And then that kind of enters into a conflict with the interpersonal politics, because it makes it difficult to relate to at a kind of personal level if I don't know her directly.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, shortly after, she made the fatal error of hiring the former Hillary Clinton campaign advisor's staff. And shortly after that, I think it was the post vote in Iowa, I think 45% or 47% of people said she was like, why didn't you vote for her? The answer was, 40-odd people, percent of people said she's too liberal, and the other 40-some-odd people said she's not liberal enough, and then there was 7% I don't know. So she...
misogynist.
She triangulated herself into a, like, irrelevancy, you know, where she wasn't really saying anything, where it was, sure, I support Medicare for all, but, sure, I do support, you know, pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but, and, it, like, there was a caveat for everything where she said, like, her, you know, Bernie's policy is Medicare for all, full stop, and then Elizabeth Warren took 15 separate tweets to try to communicate what her healthcare plan was.
I felt that way writing essays before. It's hard. And, you know, that is an academic's problem.
I guess. I mean, the problem is, though, when it comes to politics, and again, this is not something at all unique to America, we have to actually look at what are people taking away from these statements? Because Elizabeth Warren can write an essay outlining her values for all the sense that would make, like, you know, academically outlining your values seems a bit weird to me, but whatever.
I thought her statement on dropping out of the race was kind of one of those.
Yeah.
And pretty strong message given.
But I mean, it's just about what do people take away from this? Like with Bernie Sanders, you can clearly say, like, he wants to do healthcare for everyone. That's the goal. That is a thing that you can hang your hat on. You can say, if you support this, you should support Bernie Sanders. And Joe Biden's whole sort of amorphous but still understandable, like, let's go back to normalcy. I'm a normal candidate who will just, I'll be like the, you know, dead hand at the tiller. The state's not going to do weird shit anymore because I can't really do anything. So I'll just be the president. I'll just be like a warm body in a chair. And you won't have to think about politics for a while.
Yeah.
And that's an appealing idea, even amongst a lot of leftists I know. An appealing idea that, like, I don't have to care about, I don't have to think about, like, the world ending every single fucking week. You can check out, finally. You can go to brunch. You can do
so,
all
so
that.
So he's the party's junk. He's like a heroin, basically. Is that what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not good for you. It's not going to work, but good for a time. Wow.
My prediction, I think, though, that enough talk about Elizabeth Warren, it's Bernie or Biden right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Democratic voters themselves say that the most important issue to them is beating Trump in 2020. Mm-hmm. That's it. Like, you know, policies be damned for a lot of these people, except for probably most of the Bernie Sanders supporters.
Well, they're...
And I think that there are enough Bernie or bust folks, and if I were an American, I would be one of them. That I think if they nominate anyone else but him, then they'll lose. And there, conversely, there are enough vote blue no matter who folks that hate Bernie that will vote for him anyway.
Yeah.
Probably. And so I think that the Democratic Party will be lighting themselves on fire if they don't, like, cave and bend the knee and appoint Bernie. Mm-hmm.
I think there's pretty good precedent coming out of Super Tuesday for Bernie's viability to come out of these primaries and kick Trump's ass, because I think you're right, Ben, that Biden doesn't stand a fucking chance of doing that.
I think he could win.
Yeah, and you know, so there's a couple of things. First, I gotta say, like, I was on a movie date with my girlfriend that night. We went to go see Jojo Rabbit, which is maybe a little bit uncanny, but anyway. And I got to apologize now on air, on the record, because I must have been a terrible date. I was head and phone all night checking the updates coming in for really neck and neck states like Texas.
I'm surprised my F5 key is still intact.
Yeah. I think from over here I can see that it's been smudged off with your fingerprint, you know, the characters. But anyway, yeah, so there were, I mean, first off, state the obvious, Bernie won California, which was expected, but which is huge. Texas, really, really close.
Yeah.
But then there are a couple of things I want to mention about kind of what I've been hearing since Super Tuesday. One of them is we have to hold the people responsible for running the voting system accountable for all of those failures. You know, it's predominantly in university town student voting centers and, you know, poor black neighborhood voting centers where things are just prone to breaking down, having 4-hour long lines. You know, these people got to go to work. They got to get home. They got things to do. They don't necessarily have time to endure that process, and that's pre-calculated. You know it is. even if through sheer ignorance. And the other, you know, I've been hearing a lot about how Biden just did really strong among black voters in the southern states. And I just, like, I don't buy that that's really authentic, apart from the fact that he spent a shit ton of money down there and then kind of the invisible hand of Obama playing in. But I think it's being, not that it's not authentic, I don't want to say that people are voting against their interests, but just that it's being played up a lot in the kind of aftermath and commentators.
Well, I do think it's a real thing. I mean, this is, again, is something that's not unique to the states. It's an idea. I mean, I would say that that kind of voting is very similar to like union block voting in labor parties, which tend to be way more conservative and way more just sort of status quo type of things. And the reason you do that, the reason why that gets like reinforced and you argue for the we should be voting as a group and not being splintered off, is because you, that's the way you actually have a voice in a political party. If black people in the southern states voted, basically their vote was distributed in the same way that white votes were, nobody would be talking about them at all. Nobody would be caring what's, you know, black interests or anything like that. They would be completely ignored because you could ignore them. You could just treat them like anyone else and it doesn't matter. But by voting as a block and by having, you know, organizations that make that a priority, it means that they can have an important influence on the political process. Now, that does mean, because of that, you know, you end up with a very conservative sort of trends, right? Yeah, like, that's just how that works. But I get the reason why. And I, in fact, if anything, I'd like, when it comes to union block voting, I'm like, yes, generally this is like a good idea, because you need to be able to actually affect elections. And if you're a minority group inside of a larger party, that's the only way you're ever going to be able to do it. And it does lead to things like, you know, Joe Biden being the guy who just sort of soaks up all that support.
I wanted to touch back a little bit on what you were saying about the long lines at polling stations. I find it both fascinating and utterly incomprehensible how the United States runs their elections. I just can't wrap my head around it. The problem of long lineups at particularly like minority heavy polling areas has been a problem for like 25 fucking years. And it's obvious what they're trying to do. You know, they're trying to suppress the vote. They're trying to keep working class people who don't have 4 hours out of their day to spare from voting. And everyone openly acknowledges that. But nothing's done, because, and I don't profess to know the, you know, intricate differences between exactly how we have elections here versus how they have them in the United States. But from what I can understand is that there isn't a sort of independent body like Elections Canada that makes sure everyone's registered, there's enough polling stations, they're well-staffed, and so on and so on.
Not the primaries, for sure.
And, you know, this leads to other problems like gerrymandering, where the politicians write the borders of their own districts, for Christ's sake, you know? And so the DNC can basically openly rat-fuck the whole process and, like, all but admit as such.
Yeah, well, they're a political party.
And they get away with it.
Well, they're a political party. No matter how many times people say online, actually, they're not a real political party. They're a political party.
And I think a lot of this is to state the obvious, but it really does need to be mentioned time and again. I will just add that I think this is one place where you can start to see a real disparity between how people vote in the primaries and polls. You know, one kind of striking example to me of the where you see that disparity is Mike Bloomberg's pretty hilarious splashing of cash and, you know, spending, what was it, $500 million to win himself the delegates of American Samoa, which is a delightful, you know, capstone on this whole process for me looking back. But
I hope they build him a statue.
That'd be nice. He'll commission one for himself, I'm sure of it. You know, I wanted to mention a couple of days ago, so Democracy Now! Hosted a really interesting debate between Dr. Cornel West and Bobby Rush,
one of the original Black Panthers, who was endorsing Bloomberg. I could not. I honestly, I listened to about 2 minutes of that and I just couldn't.
I listened to the whole thing, but it was kind of horror show, you know? Like, I was just trying to understand where he's coming from. And Cornel West, it was great. It was a very amiable debate. You know, it was a lot of love between West and Rush, clearly. But he was constantly pushing him on things like the card check and, you know, racialized policing and all this. And just Bloomberg's very obvious, well-known track record. But a lot of it seemed to come down to the money Bloomberg spent and how he was putting himself out there, advertising himself, and just kind of the symbolic status that he has in the city. So, you know, the extent to which that inordinate amount of wealth is able to generate a huge amount of symbolic capital in advance of a poll is not, this doesn't generate the same kind of numbers you're going to see in people voting in a Democratic primary. And sure, it might feed back into it through people getting hyped up to vote one way or another.
He did pretty well. I mean, like, he didn't do very well as far as the amount of money he spent. But for someone who, it's hard to find two people on the entire planet who like him. he did really well. Like, people actually voted for him.
Yeah.
Like, that is bizarre when the only reason you'd be doing that is because he's on TV.
Yeah.
Just to talk briefly a little bit more about the chaos that is the way that the Americans conduct their elections. So there's a couple tweet threads I wanted to read out. The first is at EMYKATO3, and this is really long, so I'll probably only read a bit of it, but it's just so incredible to me. So what I witnessed yesterday as an election worker in the Los Angeles County was a crime. The election center was close between UCLA and Beverly Hills. Almost 90% of the college-age students that showed up to vote were given provisional ballots. It was over a three-hour wait. Most young voters couldn't find their voter info on the new system. They showed up with the affidavit printed out, but yet their record was nowhere to be found. Everyone who prepared a poll pass when scanned was rejected at registration. A lot of voters who had mail-in ballots didn't receive them in the mail. If they were registered as a nonpartisan voter, the crossover ballot didn't arrive after requesting it before the deadline. The new system allowed us to give them a crossover ballot, but not everyone was able to wait the 3 hours in line during lunch hour. The minute it was lunchtime, the line started growing and the new system crashed because of the overwhelming numbers of voters countywide. LA County used a new electronic system. Many older voters are not comfortable with technology. Some of them were walking out with the ballot, thinking that was their receipt. We had to chase them down and ask them to scan it back into the machine where it was collected. After casting ballots, the voter had to scan the paper back into the machine where it was collected in a sealed container that was attached to the machine. But people were confused, and they would walk over to the check-in table with their ballot after voting. We had to instruct voters to go back to the same machine and scan the ballot back in, but then some machines were occupied by other voters, so they inserted their ballot in the black box, but many people walked out not knowing what to do, even though we explained the full process. At lunch rush hour, all tablets used to check people in were slowing down. The system kept syncing, which caused every ballot to be posted as provisional. We tried switching between tablets that were not syncing. Sometimes it worked, but 90% of the time it didn't. After lunch hour, the lines got bigger. It went into an hour and a half wait time to 3 hours by 2 p.m. At that point, the tables at the pointing tables couldn't find people in the system. Even when they brought in their informational ballots, the scanner couldn't read the registered personal info. We had to register people as new voters, even though they lived at the same address for years. Even if they voted in 2018, we couldn't pull up their info because the new system was crashing. It also wouldn't allow us to print out the ballot for any new registered voters. I'll stop there, but you kind of get
Holy
the idea.
Fuck.
Yes, isn't that not like
this is a Kafka story.
Yeah. Like, reading this is infuriating.
This is the penal colony, bitches. Fuck, man.
Yeah, it's just utterly fucking astounding. For the record, for any American listeners out there, I don't mean to brag, but like, we use paper ballots, and I've barely ever waited more than 20 minutes in any election in my life.
It's pretty sweet. Some candidate should run on how many jobs it'll create to go back to paper ballots.
Yeah. Well, the last municipal election here ran an electronic system that like really slowed everything down. However, there were paper ballots. It scanned paper ballots that were then just like put in a bin, which could then be read by a person afterwards if you wanted to.
Yeah, I sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, and as far as I understand, the only people who like the electronic system are journalists who just want to report on the results sooner. Like, you just do paper ballots.
Yeah, simple. And, you know, I find it, like, frightening on an existential level to introduce anything electronic or digital into an actual democratic process. Because, I mean, computers get hacked, databases crash, everything that will go wrong will go wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I actually find it utterly incomprehensible that even in the wake of all of this, like, Russia hacking hysteria, that they still, not only still use electronic voting machines, but introduced further levels of technology, like that shadow app for Iowa and all these registration tablets. And, like, you guys have been doing these elections for, like, 200 years without this, and they worked pretty well.
Well, you know, it's just an example, right? Like, this...
A lot of those elections, they didn't let women vote, so I don't know, like, worked well, okay,
maybe they worked too well, even though they were so shitty. And, you know, I think this planned errancy is just another example of the ways in which automation and the information economy are royally rat-fucking the working class.
Yeah.
And now, let me just briefly put on my tinfoil hat here. So this is a series of tweets from Benjamin Norton, who was on our show a couple episodes ago, talked to us about Bolivia. The introduction of apps and software that can be manipulated deliberately causes the potential for rat fucking more than usual. So
that's a technical term.
Yes.
Can we run a rat fucking counter on this show?
We're at like 13 now. So
fuck away. Ding!
So Benjamin Norton begins. The official vote counts from the Massachusetts.
Are you serious? Okay, it's like mashed potatoes and then two shits. No, it's Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. Okay, that is not how it's spelled. Democratic primary differed significantly from the exit poll. Sanders won the exit poll and lost in the computer count. Discrepancies between Sanders and Biden totaled 8.2%, double the 4% margin of error. The computerized vote counts from the South Carolina Democratic primary also differed significantly from the exit poll, yet again, greatly exceeding its margin of error. Biden's vote count exhibited the largest increases, plus 8.3% from his exit poll projection. The U.S. remains one of the few major, in quotes, democracies in the world that allow computerized vote counting, not observable by the public, to determine the results of elections. Most countries protect the integrity of their elections with publicly observable hand counting of paper ballots. Noticing a pattern here, the New Hampshire Democratic primary computerized vote count results also greatly exceeded the exit poll margin of error. Buttigieg's official unverified computer-generated vote totals represent a 12% increase from the exit poll. Official unverified computer vote results in the 2016 Democratic primary significantly exceeded the exit poll margin of error. States with a paper trail showed higher support for Sanders. States without a paper trail showed much higher support for Clinton. This is all cited, by the way. The U.S. government's own soft power arm, USAID, which meddles in elections across the globe, says in its own election guide, quote, a discrepancy between the aggregated choices reported by voters, i.e. exit polls, and the official results may suggest, but not prove, that results have been tampered with.
See,
so a foreign intervention into the Iowa primary was justifiable?
I'm just saying we should call the OAS on the Democratic
primaries. Yeah, no shit. No, okay.
This is why Cuba should be in the OAS, for situations like this, where they could be like, hey, maybe we should do something.
Okay, I'm really interested in what tampering means in this context, and I'm not about to defend it, but I want to unpack what sense it might have, how that word kind of attributes agency, and a lot of this agency seems to fall back on conveniently, like, ignorant accidents that benefit the party. So, you know, it really translates well to this kind of austerity ideology and cutting away all the excess fat. Why should they even want to develop a better voting system when having a shitty one benefits them?
Well, and it works. And well, so, it does work. Yeah. It gets you to an end result that's, broadly speaking, the one you'd want.
What, so, you mean the one the DNC wants?
Well, yeah. Sure, but it doesn't have to be Biden. This is the great thing about having a system that works this way. If it was someone else, if it was another candidate, maybe they would, maybe it would work out. But if I personally, I think the main area again where it matters the most isn't so much in how the software works, but in how like equipment is maintained and who gets decent voting infrastructure. And that would then bias you towards, you know, richer, whiter neighborhoods, which is, I think, probably what they actually want. So if you're if you're a candidate who wants to win, you have to be able to appeal to richer, whiter neighborhoods, because if you try not to, or if you don't really care, you're just going to find yourself fighting one more uphill battle. Never mind the superdelegates, you know, months down the road who aren't going to like you anyway. You already are getting kind of screwed by the very voting system itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I find it, I actually posted that, the thread from Benjamin Norton on Reddit. Was like, can you fucking believe this? Like, this is a smoking gun, you know, take a look at this. And the responses were all like, yeah, of course the DNC cheats. What are you, stupid? Yeah. Like they, it was
what,
just
do you not
like,
live in America? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Well, you can't do this. Where's the independent electoral commission?
I find that in like if this happened in France, people would be taken hostage. There would be riots. They wouldn't accept it. And in America, they're just like, yep, well, gonna get fucked again. I guess that's just the way she goes.
Yeah. Oh, I get that it's really hard to understand the degree of cynicism that must come with, where everybody basically who's taking part in this process and voting in it can't be doing so in good faith because they know that it's all a lie and it's bullshit. You know, the points don't matter. What is it? The games are made up and the points don't matter. Whose line is it anyway? Line?
Yeah. That's the one.
Okay, terrific. Anyway, finally got it in the end.
That was the newer season.
Yeah, but on the other hand as well, for the candidates, it kind of creates this perverse incentive to reinforce the center the more that your decisions about, you know, how you're going to design your campaign, where you're going to go campaigning are built around information systems. I went to this really interesting talk recently where the person giving the talk talking about algorithmic bias in politics and policing, and mentioned that, you know, cops in PDs that use these heavily statistically driven policing tactics, which drive them into, you know, very racialized like neighborhoods, and, you know, just continually reproduces racist policing practices through the forces. Cops know that these approaches to policing don't work most of the time, if you ask them, but they still abide by it.
Well, they're just executing policy.
Yeah. It's so, and of course, yeah, there's a whole internal politics with police. Maybe that does extend to the Democratic Party establishment. Maybe it doesn't, but it's interesting to look at that in light of data and just the kind of fuckery, rat fuckery, ding, that you're seeing with these programs.
Well, I reckon we will be talking about the U.S. election for a while yet. So
until 2025, when the nukes start flying.
Yeah. So we're going to turn our attention for the end of this episode back to Canada, where there have been ongoing, pretty fucking rad, anti-pipeline, pro-Indigenous rights protests across the country.
Just quick shout out, I believe we have to say fake-ass country Canada now.
Yeah.
I think that's policy.
Yeah. What?
Canada, it's...
Party policy, can't... All, sorry, not up to me.
Three resource extraction corporations in a trench coat.
How about the domination of Canada?
I just want to give the biggest of ups to the anti-pipeline protesters...
Downtown, right here.
Yeah. The legislature's, well, the ledge here in Victoria was blockaded. Rail lines were shut down. Direct action, all sorts of protests. It's rad to see this come up all over the country.
Yeah. Two things. First is that we don't want to call it an anti-pipeline protest, because there have been a lot of arguments coming out of this movement to say that, no, it's not even about the pipelines, it's kind of tangential, or just the straw that broke the camel's back in this case, but it's about indigenous sovereignty. And I think in some ways that's a tactic to avoid going down the muddled road of, you know, the bringing up the elected and hereditary chief distinction as a kind of way to just have the settler colonial government railroad whatever the fuck they want.
And the pipeline can just be canceled,
it
right?
It is the real issue as well.
But, like, the pipeline can just be canceled and has happened before. I mean, that was what happened with Northern Gateway,
yeah.
Right? And it might happen with this one. Like, for all that the government is like, the pipeline's going to happen, you know, just it's just going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. These companies are actually working under fairly narrow time frames of about 20 years worth of profitable export of materials.
Yeah.
Now that can change. They can fudge those numbers.
It's not profitable now.
We just saw this with the Tex Tar Sands project.
It is profitable. The pipeline
right?
the government bought was it does make money for the companies that own the pipeline, and that's all profit is. If the profit the company gets is derived from subsidies and is derived from screwing over people, indigenous people in the province, that's still profit for the company, and they will still have a reason for doing it. It doesn't really matter at that point because they're making money. And the pipeline itself is, from their own estimates, from the company's estimates, needs to be consistently exporting this crap, LNG, out of the country for about 15, 20 years. Otherwise, my point is that if delays happen, the pipeline absolutely becomes unprofitable. It is just not worth bothering which could happen. And that's kind of why Northern Gateway ended up being abandoned, was because their window of opportunity, as it were, just disappeared. And so they went, well, you know, I'll go do other things. That could happen with this one. And the only thing I wanted to say with what Anthony was talking about is that it's not an anti-pipeline protest, because, yes, the pipeline can, for any number of good or stupid reasons, be canceled. And the underlying issues are still there. It may be, at a certain point, the government might be like, well, we'll cancel the pipeline so long as we don't address those underlying questions of sovereignty, of land, of history, basically, of what Canada is, all of that.
Well, it's interesting, actually, that as of right now, they've kind of done the exact opposite. And I think you're absolutely right. But I was hearing news about a week ago about a tentative agreement that was reached between the Fed and the hereditary chiefs over issues of indigenous sovereignty, which, to our listeners outside of BC, should briefly mention that this is ongoing and contested in British Columbia, because unlike many other parts of the country, all of the indigenous territories that we are talking about are unceded. No treaty exists.
Yeah.
And so there is a Supreme Court precedent in the Delgamuukw decision, which mandates that these the kind of sovereign institutions that these indigenous nations have in place need to be recognized. And that's being shat all over. Anyway, I digress. There are these kind of conflicting prerogatives. Apparently, in this tentative agreement that was reached, the government said, okay, we are going to work really hard at, you know, reconciliation again and rebuilding and respecting indigenous sovereignty on your lands, but not for this pipeline. This pipeline, we're still going to build it. We're going to build it through. I don't know all the details. Maybe they'll take up the hereditary chiefs on their alternative proposed route, which is another thing that's worth mentioning. But you're right that is, you know, that is so fickle. And obviously this government, you know, I'm talking broadly speaking as a kind of settler colonial institution, whether it's liberals or conservatives, have shown that they pay no mind or never put their money where their mouth is when it comes to reconciliation. And so they could just pull the rug out at any moment if it means they can make any kind of false promises now if they think it might mean that they can build this pipeline sooner and juice it a little bit.
I do think that the best evidence of that is how absolutely unwilling every layer of government is at setting a precedent that would apply to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the goal is to compartmentalize this situation so that maybe this pipeline gets, like, they want the pipeline built, but maybe it doesn't. That's an acceptable defeat, one to be avoided for the government and for these businesses, but it could happen. But it should, under no circumstances, be a precedent that could be applied to any other pipeline project, any other land issue in the province or anywhere else in the country. It will say nothing about the relationship between the Canadian state and Indigenous rights. It says nothing about the nature of sovereignty. It is simply a kind of like incidental detail off in the distance somewhere that just happens one way or the other, or who knows. And then ideally, I think for the government of BC and for the federal government, we all just kind of go home. We all forget about it. It's a settled issue. It's done. We're done.
Oh. Yeah. I think that's true. And in a lot of ways, it looks like, you know, the government and the corporations just benefit the more that they can forestall the question of Indigenous sovereignty and make the pipeline the main issue. I think you also see this bias in a lot of the mainstream media coverage about the protests, which want to make it specifically about the pipelines and, broadly speaking, in settlers' reactions, I think, if they don't necessarily understand the longer historical context to the actions that they are seeing all over the place now and, frankly, can't ignore. But, you know, the way in which the powers that be profit from this is that they can kind of hold up that manufactured indecision about indigenous sovereignty on the one hand while pummeling it on the, you know, on Wet'suwet'en lands and on the solidarity protesters and indigenous protesters in places like Victoria and all around the country, basically just breaking the legs of the material basis of solidarity with this movement that has shown such energy and is thriving and all across the land. And, you know, it's ongoing. You know, the protesters here at the ledge in Victoria have been there for weeks. You know, they're seeing arrests. I don't even know how frequently. I'm trying to keep up with it on social media, but it seems like every day or every few days there are kind of, you know, people thrown into a paddy wagon overnight and released early in the morning, hopefully.
There were five people arrested, I think, yesterday or the day before as a part of a protest because the government kind of, you know, was trying again to sort of peel away some people, and they invited people into the legislature to negotiate in respectful blah 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 blah.
He's doing air quotes.
It's all very respectful.
You can hear the air quotes.
If you hear any report from the government, they will use respect, the word respect, like every other word. It's like, we're very respectful of their respect, and we expect a respect from their respectfulness.
Have they ever listened to Aretha? You should cut that in there. Don't do me singing.
And they,
you want us to have a DMCA takedown, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, that is that you're being very generous to his singing there. But yeah, no. Basically, it was some of the people who met with a minister of, you know, ruining the environment or whatever, refused to leave the building and were then arrested.
Yeah, I want to say two things. One, I think that in the absence of a broader working class organized struggle of labor to help the fight against climate change, which is really the only way you can fight against the capitalist system, the targeted sort of disruption of economic parts of the economic machine, like blockading the rail lines, for example, is genius. I think that was extremely effective at putting this on the table. It got the Chuds, their jimmies were rustled. They were upset, which is always a good sign. And, you know, basically, I also want to say that it's the pinnacle of irony where communities out east were complaining about, you know, not being able to get their chlorine by rail, and that, you know, soon enough we're going to have boil water advisories in our communities. Like, oh yeah, you know who else has
that would be a real
boil
shame.
Water advisories? Yeah. Like over 100 First Nations communities across the country.
There's,
and that's
way
been
more
going
than
on
that still.
For forever.
Yeah.
Secondly, I want to say that I find that the estimated carbon emissions for the LNG project up north in British Columbia to be utterly unconscionable. In fact, the estimated output, and let's remember that LNG is associated with methane emissions, which is like
farts.
Dozens.
Do you like farts?
It's dozens.
No,
it's not.
Should,
in all seriousness, it's like in dozens of times more potent of a greenhouse gas for like climate death than CO2 is. And so the, if I'm recalling this correctly, the total amount of emissions estimated for the LNG project up north in BC exceeds the total amount of emissions that BC's climate target for 2050 puts our, so it will be 100% of our emissions if the climate target is successful, which it won't be with this project.
Yeah, well, we'll be almost at Alberta's per capita level.
Question: what is more toxic for the environment, methane gas emissions or settler tears, baby? Settler tears. Give me those settler tears. That wasn't a serious question. But I would
D,
like to
all of the above.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, there is Supreme Court precedent as well that when it comes to indigenous land claims, the hereditary chiefs are the chiefs that you need to be listening to, not the kind of artificial electoral system imposed by the colonial government. And these traditions far precede anything that we sowed here.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're clearly not anti-democratic, is I guess what I'm trying to convey here, well, which is how they kind of tend to be constructed in comparison with the electoral chiefs, because they have electoral or elect in their name.
You know, we were
electoral
talking
systems suck! We just saw that!
We were talking about that. The electoral system can be undemocratic. I guess I would say two things. One is that, yeah, absolutely, the hereditary chiefs are part of the current UN, and to be perfectly honest, the Canadian government's understanding of what it means to do reconciliation with these nations. So to ignore them is to just abandon all of that. Both the UN, you know, both UNDRIP,
which they're perfectly happy.
Well,
they're trying to
like, you know, slice the salami on this, where it's like, well, the hereditary chiefs, they're not actually representing anyone. They're just representing their own opinions. They're not, you know, democratic or whatever, and that's just a lie. And secondly, I think the much more fundamental issue here is that what a lot of the arguments about this are is basically saying, like, well, you know, Indigenous people just shouldn't do politics, basically. They just shouldn't have opinions on things.
Yeah.
There just shouldn't be a, an actual means by which they interact with political questions. They should either just let us do whatever we want to them, or be some kind of absurdly unified, impossible, ahistorically unified force that all says no in unison, and then maybe we'd listen. But unless they do that, then, you know, it doesn't count.
And it's completely fucking infantilizing. And I think you're right. You know, it's a continuation of what one calls the noble savage myth, where Indigenous people in colonized territory are basically, you know, ahistorical, one with nature, couldn't be riven with internal political dissent because they don't really have politics and all this bullshit. And it's completely self-serving. But there has been this tendency, I think, even in Trudeau's comments, which were infuriating, about the protests, solidarity protests and pipeline protests all across the country, which is basically, you know, we just need to get back to work. We all need to grow up. We need to return to order. It's time to put down your toys, quit throwing a tantrum. And he really tried to crack down, like, the goatee-wearing daddy that he now is. And it was just such a psych because, you know, I don't see infantilization. I see hundreds of years, thousands of years even, of wisdom built up in a united front of anger against the current colonial state of affairs. Fine, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I have not seen infantilized politics like as intensely as I've seen it in some of the kind of coverage that local news stations are giving to the just aggrieved settlers when there's a bridge being blockaded and they need to get to their gym by 6 o'clock so they can not be late for their Pilates class. And it's like their entire development of a political stance is either so fickle or so amorphous that they decided on a whim based on personal convenience. And I can't conceive of doing politics that way. People need to grow the fuck up. But it really bears some truth about who the little kiddies are,
that,
right?
That reminds me of editorial cartoon that was in the Times Colonist, where this was around the time of the earlier protests against the LNG project in this city, where if I can use a word description of this cartoon, there
word
was an
image.
Yes, there was a maze, you know, start end, uh-huh. You find the way through Amazing. The maze, and at all the dead ends were protesters. And the end of the maze was the doctor's appointment that you were supposed to go to, and the doctor said, "Sorry, we're going to have to reschedule for 3 months from now." And my thought reaction on this was like, why are you blaming the protesters when this is a self-own against our like piss poor excuse for a well-funded medical healthcare system? Like,
yeah, no shit.
The problem is obviously that the next scheduled appointment is 3.5 months from now, not the fucking protesters.
Yeah, all
this is more of an indictment of our shitty fucking healthcare system.
You gotta draw a big ass circle around the whole maze and write indigenous lands, and then write some words on top of the maze itself, read settler bullshit.
Yeah, if editorial cartoons need anything, it's more, labels on things in them.
I want an anatomical diagram.
Yeah. So, and honestly, I want to just extend even more big ups to the anti-LNG protests. Like, I think that it is utterly hypocritical for the BC government to, on one hand, endorse and say that they're in favor of the United Nations rights of Indigenous people, and then on the other, at the soonest possible convenience,
whenever it
just
matters,
completely throw that out the window.
Yeah, no, the protesters have been great. I mean, I work night shifts, and when I'm bagged and going home, they're still there, right?
Hats off, folks.
Yeah,
hats
absolutely
off.
And I do think it is absolutely the height of hypocrisy and just funny that we have a prime minister whinging about hereditary chiefs when his entire political career exists
because
his dad
tattoo.
Was prime minister.
Yeah.
He's there because he inherited his life. And in a way, no one wanted. No one decided on. He doesn't represent anyone but himself in this. It's just, you know, he has the right last name. He's he is that monarchical inheritance we all hate. That no one wants, and he's there saying, like, you know, it's really, you know, they should be listening to the Democratic blah 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 elected.
I don't want to put Trudeau on the psychoanalyst's couch here.
Go on.
But do you feel like he might have some unresolved daddy issues here and see this as his Oka crisis and needs to make a strong showing?
No.
That depends if his real father is, in fact, Fidel Castro.
The goatee!
I think
it uncanny.
Yeah, I think he just has a personality crisis, and the facial hair is just an example of that. He cannot figure out who he is. That's the real
he
psychoanalysis.
Fake ass prime minister.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a you know, French musketeer 1 week, and I'm Indian the next, and whatever else I need to be. Yeah. Who knows?
Settler colonialism, psychoanalysis, and the prime minister's identity. There's your straight
episode title.
Straight to, you know, top tier publication academic essay title, folks.
On a final note, I would just like to give our offer up our podcast contribution to the Bernie Sanders spirit bomb energy ball.
Is that a Goku?
Yes.
Yeah. And, I would like to follow that up with, you know, hey, Bernie Sanders 2024, baby. He's going to make it. He's going to do it.
Well, yeah, because he's going to get elected
episode.
This motherfucking year.
Yeah, sure.
6-part episode on charging the Bernie spirit bomb, because that's how long it takes to slay Biden.
So
next week on Unreal.
I'm charging a spirit bomb. You can't see it.
Well, everyone, thanks for tuning in. We're going to hope for better news next week. We got a lot of exciting content to deliver to you in the near future. So keep on tuning in. If you want to buy us a beer, we're on Patreon. Follow us on Twitter. Don't forget to hit like and subscribe. Thanks for tuning in.
And as always, we are part of the Ricochet Media Podcast Network. On the network, you can find other great political podcasts like Alberta Advantage, the film review podcast Kino Lefter, and Unpacking the News with Andre Goulet. Thanks for tuning in, listeners.